Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, Tom talks to Salman Rushdie about being Salman Rushdie. We talk to Jill Alexander Essbaum about her new novel, Hausfrau. Today, we make an exception to our KPFK-mandated ban on straight white males and welcome author Jerry Stahl. And Laurie and Tom's neighbor came over on the last show. Shane was over here to talk about his roses, and we couldn't get rid of him. And because of that, we ran out of time for BJ Novak. We apologize to BJ. He's back. We will have him on today. Joining me are my co-hosts, the professor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Привет.
And journalist, editrix, but what she really wants to do is direct, Laurie Weiner.
Sapa.
So, Tom, you couldn't convince Salman Rushdie to come to the studio.
He wasn't going to fly out just for the radio show, and I feel that that was a little cherry, but...
Such a snob.
We didn't have that in our budget.
We did not have that in our budget. The novel is 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, which is, if you add them all up, 1,001 nights.
Oh, right? I get it.
Yeah. And we had a really fun conversation.
We really don't have that in our budget?
We really don't have that in our budget. Salman Rushdie, welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
The first thing I want to say is this novel is just so much fun.
Oh, good. Well, it was kind of fun to do it.
It really is a novel of ideas.
Yes, I think so. And I think one of the things that this kind of area of fiction, the kind of, you know, fantasy, science fiction area of fiction, has always, I think, been a very good vehicle for novels of ideas, you know. So the form lends itself to it.
There's a djinn. Djinn is the singular. What's the plural?
No, djinn is the plural. Djinni is the singular.
Oh, okay.
Hence genie.
One of the genies loves the golden age of science fiction,
mm-hmm.
and rattles off a whole series of authors. And I'm taking it that you do as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I was first in England at boarding school, I discovered that period, you know, that so-called golden age, which I suppose then in the 60s was still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, of course, you know, it's easy to be a fan of Bradbury and Vonnegut and those big names that, if you like, kind of crossed over into the mainstream. But I was just as much a fan of these other writers with the wonderful names, you know. L. Sprague de Camp.
Yeah, yes, right.
Frederick Pohl and C. M. Kornbluth.
And because of when Midnight's Children hit and kind of put you in a big way on everybody's map, literary map, mm-hmm. it was always talked about as magical realism.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem with the term is that when people use it, they only hear the magical and they don't hear the realism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they think of it as basically fantasy fiction, but I think the thing that makes it work is that it's so strongly rooted in some idea of the real world.
Yes.
And I've always thought about my writing that I try and always make sure it has deep roots in the real, because I think unless you root it properly, it just becomes whimsical, and to my mind, it's not interesting then, or it's just a children's book.
At the center of this is the fight between Ibn Rushd and Al-Ghazali, and their fight, in a way, is about the real and its relation to the entire category that's opposed to the real.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, that the novel arises out of that strange dialogue between the two of them. Of course, they would never really have been able to have that dialogue because they lived in different countries 100 years apart.
Right.
At the philosophical level, the argument they had, which you could now say is the argument between, if you like, modern ideas and what we now have begun to call fundamentalism. I mean, that argument continues. And Ghazali, who was the conservative of the two, is the one whose ideas really won the battle, unfortunately. And the strange thing about Ibn Rushd, or Averroes as he's known in the West, is that he wasn't in the end that influential inside the Arab and Islamic world, but he was colossally influential outside it.
Eventually.
You know, Western philosophers, I mean, Thomas Aquinas was very affected by him. And even the Renaissance humanist philosophers, you know, were very affected by reading him.
At one point you say the genies are uninterested in fiction, that the genies are realists.
Yeah, there are no books in fairyland.
Right.
And, They just go about their business, which seems to involve having gigantic amounts of sex. That was my addition, by the way. There's a certain amount of the material about genies in the novel which comes out of studying what's written about them. But the sex, I'm afraid, is my addition.
Yes, well, thank you for that. We appreciate that.
Years ago, when I saw Wim Wenders' film, The Wings of Desire, mm-hmm. he has this very attractive idea that the angels peering down from the architecture in Berlin are envious of human beings because of their capacity to feel. And the angels want to be more like us. And I, in a way, have a sort of version of that in this novel, which is the jinn are very interested in human beings because human life is more interesting than life in fairyland. There's a lot more going on. Human beings are more complicated, contradictory. They're just more interesting people. And in the case of the main female character in the novel, the Princess Dunya, she actually falls in love with human beings.
Right, and that makes sense in relation to what you were saying about science fiction needing to be grounded in the real to be interesting, mm-hmm. because it's the frailty and the mortality of human beings that their limits which give them their interest, both to the genius
and to
us.
Yes, and I mean, Dunya, you know, for Dunya, the great discovery is love.
And her children are half human, half jinn, and so they tend to have some kind of superpowers as well.
Some of them, yeah.
Some of them, mm. yeah. And
yes.
You love superpowers, right?
I grew up with Superman and Batman. I'm in favor of superpowers.
Yeah. But it struck me that the people who get superpowers, especially in this novel, but actually in some of your other novels as well, they kind of resent them. They interpret their superpowers as a curse or a problem. Like Mr. Geronimo has a levitation problem.
Yes. I think, you know, if the laws of gravity cease to apply to you in your vicinity, that sort of is a problem. And one of the things that Mr. Geronimo was just about the first thing I had in the book, this idea of a man who loves the earth, who spent his life literally tending to the earth, and is then, for reasons he can't explain, detached from it. And not like floating up into the sky, but just half an inch off the ground. I mean, you know, which is as great a breach of the law of gravity as if he were 20 feet up. And then, see, one of the things I think about writing this kind of stuff is that once you've had the idea, you have to take that idea completely seriously and work out what the consequences would be. Such as, for example, how do you drive a car if your behind is half an inch off the seat? And you're therefore the pedals are further away than they should be. How do you go to the bathroom? And I think that's, again, you know, the kind of realism part of magic realism is that in order for people to accept what you're saying, you know, in order for Kafka's readers to accept that Gregor Samsa has turned into a bug, you have to take his bugginess very seriously.
This is Seth Greenland here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on the LARB Radio Hour, KPFK 90.7 FM, and we are now returning to Tom's conversation with Salman Rushdie about his novel 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights.
Well, this may be a little far-fetched. Tell me if you think it is. I was preparing for the interview. I ran across one of your philanthropic projects, which is, it's a lunch program for children in Soweto.
Yes. And well, not just Soweto, but several townships.
Several townships.
In South Africa, yes. Uh-huh.
And it struck me that compared to school children in Soweto, you and I and most of the people we know have superpowers. We can fly around the world. And yet we tend to interpret our lives as full of problems, like there's just too much levitation going on in our lives.
Yeah. I think that's well said. Yes, we obviously... We live in the privileged corner of the earth, and we're very ungrateful for it. But I mean, one of the things I wanted to say is that, yes, we, you know, human beings are capable of much more than we think we are. That actually in a crisis, which is in this case a war, people become capable of things that they didn't know they were capable of. You know, they have courage that they didn't understand that they had. They have, you know, endurance. They have abilities that they wouldn't normally have backed themselves to have because extreme circumstances bring that out of us.
Now, I assume that you mean a lot of these kind of references to the attempts by these malevolent genies to take over the world. they're related in some way to radical Islamists. That is, there's a kind of, it's even called a caliphate at one point, and they're kind of, you know, their kind of lack of pluralism is meant to be taken as a political comment. Is that fair to say?
Well, at least one of the jinn becomes, you know, influenced by the extremist religious ideas of Ghazali, who he encounters. But I really wanted them to be more just like a principle of malevolence rather than literally an allegory of what's happening in the news, you know, because it seemed to me that obviously the structure of the novel has some kind of an origin point in what's going on in the world. But I wanted to, the reason the novel is the shape it is and not a realist novel is that I thought that the work of talking about the real thing is perhaps better done by journalism. And I wanted to try and reach for something a little beneath that, which was this idea that the battle between reason and unreason, between, you know, civilization and barbarism, is an eternal battle. It's not just about what's happening now. It's always happening. It's not even only an external battle in the world. It's also an internal battle. Because I think we all have civilized aspects and barbaric aspects within us. We all have the rational and the irrational at war within us too. And so there's a point somewhere late in the novel where it's suggested that the jinn are like our own darker selves. And so the battle, which in the novel is an external battle, it's a physical battle between armies of the two sides. But you could also understand that as an internal battle. And so I was trying to reach for that kind of material rather than simply allegorize the world as it is.
That is a beautiful place for us to end, and I really appreciate you joining us today. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Some of our listeners might be surprised to learn we actually have the capacity to do a telephone interview.
I'm shocked to learn that. I did not know that.
I didn't know it either.
We can do one. And our producer in Moral Conscience, Jerry Gorin, has set it up so we can talk to Jill Alexander Essbaum about her new novel, Hausfrau. She's on the line. Welcome, Jill, to the LARB Radio Hour.
Hi there. How's it going?
I want to say grüezi.
Ah, grüezi miteinander.
Which is Schweizerdeutsch for hello. It's the only word I know.
Entschuldigen bitte?
No, that's German. And this is a novel about a woman who lives outside of Zurich.
Yes.
And who is massively adulterous.
Massively adulterous. That's a very good way to put it. She's massively adulterous and very alienated and a little bit maybe unhappy, I think might be a nice way to put it. Maybe not too much of a spoiler on that one. I certainly wouldn't call her a sex addict. I think maybe her adultery is in response to her alienation and unhappiness. She's married to a Swiss banker because, of course, he's a Swiss banker, aren't they all? And she's an American, and she doesn't speak the language very well because, you know, it's not easy to speak German, and it's even more difficult to speak Swiss German.
Well, one of the things I love about the book is that it's got these three different kind of registers going on. One is about her life. One is about psychoanalysis, and in particular, Jungian psychoanalysis, because she's talking to her analyst throughout the book. And one is about language itself, because she's taking German lessons now, 7 or 8 years into her living there. And you use those language lessons in very fun and interesting ways.
Yeah, it's really funny because that's not something you can wrench into place, you know. It sort of falls out that way. And I've been thinking a lot about what comes first, like the language or the idea behind it. I don't even know how to say that, but the words that we use to talk about grammar, they do evoke these other kinds of ideas, passivity, tense.
Right. And of course, Schweizerdeutsch is such an odd language. I spent some time on the lake of Zurich many, many years ago, and everybody was listening to a comedian whose whole show apparently was just making fun of his own language. I mean, there was nothing funny about what he was saying. It was just his exaggeration. You say the language itself leaps from the back of the throat like an infected tonsil trying to escape.
Yeah, right? It's I hope they're not going to take that as an insult.
There's something about the book that I assume other people picked up on more quickly than I did, which is that the heroine's name is Anna. And one of the source texts is Anna Karenina.
How long did it take you to
pick
up on that?
I was on page 323. No, I didn't notice it right away. But you are kind of retelling the kind of classic stories of female desire in the literary canon in a way.
You know, I'm going to tell a big secret here. That's really not the main source text. It's Madame Bovary.
Okay.
And it's the setup of Madame Bovary is the one that I had in mind. Her name's Anna and some other stuff. But it's, you know, if you think of like Emma Bovary, she's married to a man who's not terrible, but maybe not the best husband for her. And she lives a kind of provincial life, and how she fights against it is with all these, you know, affairs. And her reasons behind it are different than Anna's, but I don't know. After sort of the setup, I like to think it kind of becomes its own book because it's in a different place and in a different time. And I like to think that not every woman responds to the same sort of heartbreak in the same sort of way. You know, I think that one of the critiques that the book has gotten is that, you know, oh, well, she's making a statement about women that's a bit archaic. And to that, I generally say, well, no, I'm making a statement about this woman.
I really felt like it was a very much an updating of those classic tales, Madame Bovary, but also Edna Pontellier in Kate Chopin's The Awakening. And
Thank you for saying Edna Pontellier. That was the other one I had in mind.
Uh-huh. There are ways in which you're playing on those older texts and saying, actually, you know, if we understand what we now understand about things like depression and alienation, we would write those books differently than those authors wrote them 100 years ago.
You know, there's another book that I actually had in mind when I wrote this, and it was one of the books that I read very early on in my stay in Switzerland. It's Josephine Hart's book, Damage.
I remember that book. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that that book influenced me to a great deal.
And this is your first novel after being well known as a poet. Is this going to be your last novel? Are you going to do it again?
Oh, I want to do it again. I'm sold on this.
Jill Alexander Essbaum, the new novel is Hausfrau. Thanks for coming in to talk to us or talking to us on the phone.
Thank you so much.
I'm Seth Greenland here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner here on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 FM, KPFK. Jerry Stahl has written novels, nonfiction, television, and movies. He's the author of the memoir Permanent Midnight. He's currently on the staff of Marin, and he's here to talk about his new book, OG Dad. Jerry Stahl, welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you so much. It's great to be LARBed.
You know, I noticed that on Amazon, it's number one in books / parenting and relationships / family relationships / fatherhood / former heroin addicts.
Did you? Yeah.
Which is great.
I've nailed down that niche. Yeah.
When did you come up with the idea for the book? I mean, when did you know you were going to write this book?
It's actually a collection of columns that I did for The Rumpus.
Right. Oh, right.
So I
yeah.
never really thought it was going to be a book. To get through the weirdness of parenthood without heroin, I was just writing constantly, and The Rumpus was kind enough to.
Well, that kind of goes to my first thought when I heard you had done the book. And I know you're the father of a daughter who's an adult now. Yeah,
26, yes.
And how have you apprehended parenthood differently the second time around? And obviously, the quick answer is it's without junk. But what does that mean?
What it means is you're aware of all the menace. And in this case, it's not just personal and emotional. It's, you know, it's leaving a cell phone next to the bed and knowing the blastoma is going to come careening into her brain pan. And the fact that there's not going to be any water and she'll be grubbing for cancer scraps in like 2028. it all just plagues me and obsesses me. And in that sense, I do wish I had heroin to blot out that reality.
Was your anxiety level...
I hope that's not too upbeat an answer.
No, that's what we expect. Was the anxiety level manageable and then the kid just ramped the anxiety level to...
I didn't really have that much anxiety about it. It was just like, this is horrible. What do I care? No,
well,
I cared. But when you have a little child and you just see like she's helpless to defend herself against these rampaging, no longer antibiotic, you know, defensible diseases and such, it somehow it becomes personal.
Your last novel, Happy Mutant Baby Pills, is about some of these issues.
And there's an odd confluence of events, which is I had hepatitis C from being on dope forever. You know, I was doing all the alternative medicine stuff, but to make a long story short, I sort of stopped doing the throw oat bran at the moon kind of cure. And oddly enough, at Cedars-Sinai, they had this trial drug program. And for 12 weeks, it was like bad acid. But the thing of it is, the day I went on it was the day I found out essentially my wife was pregnant.
Mm.
Well, girlfriend at the time. And they said, oh, and by the way, after I took my first dose, if you so much as get a drop of sweat on a pregnant woman, the kid will be born with like dorsal fins and a 3-day beard. So
how did they know that? That's
they knew the specific specific deformations.
So, but you seriously could not touch your girlfriend, wife?
No, I couldn't. So just to be safe, she went back with her people in Austin where they were currently.
For the entire duration of the
pregnancy? For the rest of the pregnancy, yeah. I came in at the end after I was cured and safe because it was only 12 weeks, but it was a grim, weird 12 weeks. It was, like I say, being on bad acid.
And this knocked out the hep C.
In a week.
What was that like psychologically? Because you're carrying around that burden for a long time, that hep C, that ticking clock that's ticking really fast. And you're...
Well, I haven't told I had a year to live for like ever.
And it, and suddenly it gets lifted. What was that like?
Horrible. No.
It was disorienting, yeah?
Well, it was kind of disorienting. You know, there's the grim revelation in my case that my entire adult life, I've either been strung out or dying, you know? And having hep C, you're just like crushingly fatigued. It's like having a hangover every day without ever getting loaded, you know? As Maron says, you were that creepy, damp guy who walked in a room and depressed everybody, you know?
But one of the things that this book kind of allowed you to do is really talk about joy and ecstasy in a, in a new way, right?
In an unashamed way,
yes.
It's funny, Hubert Selby once told me that it's, you know, it's very easy to write about hate, but to write about love or anything you feel love for, that's sort of the impossible task for the writer without having it be like cheese ball.
So do you feel like you need to shield your kid from your pessimism somewhat?
I think it's even deeper than that. I mean, I have the genetic propensity for just massive depression and, you know, I come from a family, not to brag, of suicides and electroshock victims. So,
that is so conceited.
There's that, you know,
show off.
I know, there I go, you know, what a big head I have. I mean, of course, you know, I worry about that. But you know, I'm working, you know, pessimism is, or negativity, that's like, I'm working my way up to that. You know, it's more of a just cellular level kind of despair that you don't, I mean, you know, my father checked himself out, went into the garage, you know, I was like 16 and, you know, that happened. And my mother, late mother, God bless her. I'm boasting again, but we used to think she was on vacation and she was like a Western psychiatric getting electroshock way back in the day, which is a very strange process because it's like charging a battery. Like you're sort of happy and okay for a while, and then it just gradually winds down and you're back to where you were, if not worse.
But it is one of the fears that you said at a cellular level, I mean, that you actually are watching to see whether there is depression in the genes, you know, that kind of thing.
That's it, but there's also just the global attack on our very being, yeah. You know, that we've engendered ourselves. I don't want to sound too KPFK-ish here, but
it's the right place for it.
It's the right place for it. But, you know, you don't have to listen to Naomi Klein or Helen Caldicott or all of them. And they're all right. It's all coming in the mail. And that's what really scares me. It's just, you can't protect them.
Yeah, it's true that, you know, in the long history of approaching Armageddon, Malthus, and on and on, mm-hmm. there's never been quite as much science backing it
up. Well, it's like Nick Tasha says, my old happy-go-lucky pal Nick Tasha, you know, the apocalypse has already happened, but it was so boring we didn't notice, you know. And, you know, it's stuff, you know, you look at the world now and it's like, it is over. It's just taking a very long, slow period of time for us to realize that it's the end.
So given that, it's nice that you have a staff job.
It is a great way to stave off the impending. It's interesting for me because I spent my whole, I don't know that I had any particular skill as a writer, but I knew that I wanted a job where I didn't have to leave the house and I could do alone and like naked at 3 a.m. And
we're all like, yes.
And
yes.
I didn't want to be around other people. I think, but you know, I've learned in my dotage here that, you know, I kind of love it because you're just shooting this shit all day with a lot of super funny people. Marin's hysterical. Dave Anthony, another comedy on staff, is hysterical. And it's kind of like, if you got to work for a living, why the hell not? You know.
So you'd never done a staff gig, right?
Never. I had a consultant. I was a consulting producer or consult whatever on a CSI for a couple of years, and got to do some really demented, insane things on the CBS Family Hour at 9 o'clock. You know, adult infantilism and other wonderful things.
So Jerry, what's next?
You know, I don't know about you, but for me, every time talking about a novel is like ripping out a fetus and showing it to people and saying, hey, look.
That's what I'm asking you to do, yeah.
No, I am keeping my loins closed.
But you are working on a novel.
I'm working on a novel. I got a movie I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Show the fetus. Show the fetus. Jerry Stahl, the book is OG Dad, Weird Shit Happens When You Don't Die Young. Jerry Stahl, thanks for coming in to talk to us.
It's a real treat, thanks.
Thanks to Salman Rushdie, Jill Alexander Asbaum. Our thanks to Jerry Stahl. Our apologies once again to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. We really hope that he will continue to show us the graciousness that he's displayed in our what's becoming long relationship with him.
He's been really terrific.
He's really been a sport, and we appreciate that. Our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. We want to thank Jerry. Our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. And of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs. And we couldn't do this show without the generosity of the Gold Hirsch Foundation. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, I'm Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. Tom, do we have more than 2 ratings on iTunes?
No.
Still only 2 ratings.
Lori?
My dad said he'd put one up.
Go to your phones, go to your computers. We need ratings. See you next week.